You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Kill by Laughter, Humor in the Fountainhead by Robert Mayhew.
I have to confess to being nervous for the first time in ages in public speaking. I thought I got over that. One of the reasons is you are huge, speaking numerically in most cases. And also, you've been treated to a cavalcade of really excellent speakers who are capable of working without a net. I, however, need a net. I've got a script in front of me that I'm going to be tethered to. I was going to mention that that's how Ayn Rand did it, but that seemed to be presumptuous, so I won't. All right. I also have to thank my wife. She insisted on ironing my shirt this morning. I said, "F it, they won't notice." But then I'm looking at this huge thing, and I think she's right. So I'm grateful for that. So enough of the humorous stuff. Let's get going. This is well, as you'll see, in some ways, an earnest topic. Now, early in The Fountainhead, when Peter Keating's mother informs Howard Rourke that the dean had called, she adds, quote, "the dean himself, through his secretary," unquote. Now, I find that an amusing remark. It's one that helps establish the character of this person quite economically. I mean, she's a cheap second-hander. Status is very important, and having an even tenuous connection to someone with a higher status is really important to her. Right. And there's a lot of this sort of humor in The Fountainhead, which is Ayn Rand's most satirical novel. I mean, certainly if you compare it to Atlas Shrugged, right? But in referring in the subtitle of my talk to humor in The Fountainhead, I'm not speaking primarily about these kinds of humorous nuggets. Rather, I'm more interested in the conception of humor found in The Fountainhead, or to put it another way, I'm interested in The Fountainhead as a source for understanding Ayn Rand's conception of humor. Now, I've long been interested in the subject of humor. One of my first lectures before an objectivist audience in 1989, yeah, I'm that old, was on Aristotle on humor. In 1998, I gave a lecture on Aristotle and Ayn Rand on humor at the American Philosophical Association meeting. And in 2000, I gave a course on Ayn Rand on humor at an objectivist conference. It wasn't called OCON, I think, at the time. And in 2007, I published an essay, Humor in the Fountainhead, which is in this collection, Essays on Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, which I'd like to plug. And I'll be drawing on that somewhat today. But in every one of these cases, this earlier work that I've done on humor, my interest in humor was, in a way, philosophical, or rather, a matter of scholarly detection. I wanted to know what we can discover about the views of humor in Aristotle and Ayn Rand, because it's not always laid out explicitly, why they have the views they do, what are the connections between their conceptions of humor and their more fundamental philosophies. And in the case of Ayn Rand, I was also interested in the different roles that humor played in her three main novels. But why return to the subject of humor again? Well, part of the reason is that we are this week celebrating the 75th anniversary of The Fountainhead, and that is an excellent work, as I've implied, around which to center a discussion of humor. And as I mentioned in my lecture description, The Fountainhead is the novel in which Ayn Rand's conception of humor comes across most clearly. And humor, I hope to make clear, is connected to some of the more fundamental or more essential ideas and issues presented in the novel. Okay. But my main reason for returning to this subject is more earnest, because what constitutes proper and improper humor has become a much more urgent issue, on which a discussion of humor in The Fountainhead will hopefully shed some light. So here's some earnest stuff. On January 7th, 2015, two Islamic terrorists forced their way into the Paris headquarters of Charlie Hebdo and opened fire, killing 12 people, including some of their cartoonists. Now, Charlie Hebdo, as you probably is aware, it's a French satirical magazine. It advertises it or presents itself as being on the far left, atheistic, skeptic, anti-religion, etc. And they included in their articles rather crudely drawn and often just plain crude cartoons. Now, they're quite critical of religion, and not simply of Islam, but of course it was their criticisms and cartoons of Islam, making fun of Islam, that prompted the murders. Now, in the aftermath of this, fellow cartoonist Gary Trudeau, the creator of Doonesbury, had this to say, expressing the views of many on the left, criticizing Charlie Hebdo, quote, "Traditionally, satire has comforted the afflicted while afflicting the comfortable. Satire punches up against authority of all kinds, the little guy against the powerful. Great French satirists always punched up," bracket, that's BS, unquote, "but holding up the self-satisfied and hypocritical to ridicule. Ridiculing the non-privileged is almost never funny. It's just mean," unquote. Now, I think Trudeau is taking an attitude that was very popular in the 60s and beyond, especially on the left, namely the idea that sacred cow makes the best hamburger, right? But he's revising this attitude to exclude sacred texts, or at least certain sacred texts, and probably sacred cows as well. I was tempted to say literal sacred cows, but you know what I mean. I'm assuming the cows that are regarded as sacred, you know, the bovine animal, is actually normal, not sacred. But, you know, so he would probably rule that out as well as off limits to humor. In any case, I would expect Trudeau would object to making fun of sacred cows, as I just did, as he would consider the over 1 billion adherents of Hinduism to be a marginalized people. And he said as much about the world's over 1.5 billion Muslims. It was wrong to make fun of Muhammad and draw cartoons and stuff because they're a marginalized people. So the sacred that he regularly makes hamburger out of is somewhat limited in ways that we'll elaborate on shortly. Incidentally, Gerard Alessandrini, who created Spamilton, that's a parody of the popular musical Hamilton, he said in an interview, quote, and I owe this example to Ed Locke, quote, "The more sacred cow something is, the more you should parody it, and the funnier it's going to be," unquote. Now, that's very much this 60s attitude, but I'm wondering, would he really make a musical parody of the Quran? I kind of doubt it. Now, for any of you who think that leftists are a lot unhealthier than Christian conservatives, and I think there's an argument to make there, keep in mind that the New Testament is full of passages in the same spirit as Trudeau's remarks, and is ultimately the source, or one of them, of this attitude. Matthew 20:16, "So the last shall be first, and the first last." James 1:9-10, "Let the brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted, but the rich in that he is made low." Okay. I should mention that I would have had some respect for Trudeau had he criticized Charlie Hebdo on the grounds that one ought to treat religion seriously. This is the view of Victor Hugo, for example. In Les Miserables, in his criticism of the convent, the idea of the convent, Hugo writes, quote, "The taking of the veil or the cowl is a suicide repaid with eternity. We do not think that on such a subject mockery is appropriate." And probably in the Enlightenment in France, there was a lot of mockery at this time. He continues, "Everything it involves is serious, the good as well as the bad. The just man frowns, he never sneers. We understand anger, not malice," unquote. If one held such a view, however, and Trudeau of all people is in no position to claim to do so, one would not choose those murders in Paris as the appropriate occasion to express it. Anyway, I'll have a lot more to say later about sneers and malice. So what should we make of Gary Trudeau's view of humor? Right. In The Fountainhead, Ellsworth Toohey says, "Don't bother to examine a folly. Ask yourself only what it accomplishes." But that's bad advice. We ought to do both, right? So let's start, though, with what he suggests. First, what does Trudeau's view of humor accomplish? Well, it gives him free rein to mock and sneer at whatever he chooses to call privileged, right, or up, while insulating from criticism whatever he considers non-privileged or down. So that's what his view of humor accomplishes. In what follows, we'll have occasion to examine the folly further. But note for now that Trudeau is actually right about two related points. One, humor involves punching, metaphorically. That is, it involves a negative evaluation or dismissal of its object, right? It is destructive in this way. And two, the morality or propriety of humor depends on its object, right? On the object of humor, on who is getting punched, okay? And I hope this becomes clear in what follows and where precisely Trudeau goes radically wrong. And I'm not suggesting that this is some, you know, just minor mistake on his part. And along the way, of course, I want us to appreciate the satirical nature of humor, the satirical nature of the Fountainhead. Now, note that there's a lot to say about the nature of humor, and particularly its mechanics, the role of ingenuity and surprise, that it involves a certain view of reality and of the human mind, that I won't be able to get into to here, at least not in detail. I'll touch on some of this. I'll be focusing on one important topic, the objects of humor, that is, proper and improper objects of humor. And for more on these other topics, I recommend the interview that Ayn Rand gave on humor. Specifically, that was the subject of it. And it's collected in the Objectively Speaking. And from what we heard last night, it'll be available for free online because it's one of the Columbia University radio shows. So that's good. All right. Now, the arch-villain of The Fountainhead, Ellsworth Toohey, I mean, it's, you all know that, right? It won't be on the trivia quiz tonight. I beg your pardon. I'm allergic to everything in nature, and there's apparently more of it in California than in New Jersey, so I've been coughing quite regularly. I'll try not to mess you guys in the back up too much. Sorry about that. The arch-villain of The Fountainhead, Ellsworth Toohey, presenting his recipe for achieving power, recommends that we kill by laughter. And yet the novel opens with the hero laughing. Since we know that these opening three words, what are they? Yeah, there you go. Howard Roark laughed. We know that these do not describe a moment of weakness or malice on the part of the hero. We can assume that, according to Ayn Rand, there is good laughter, proper humor, and bad laughter, improper humor. And what's more, that some of the latter, the improper humor, is in some way deadly. One can use it to kill, in some sense, right? So let's try to sort this out. And we'll begin at the beginning. Howard Roark laughed. At what was he laughing? Well, a few paragraphs later, Ayn Rand tells us, quote, "He laughed at the thing that had happened to him that morning and at the things which now lay ahead," unquote. A little later, we learn, quote, "That morning, he had been expelled from the architectural school of the Stanton Institute of Technology," unquote. So he laughs at his expulsion, but then he stops laughing, quote, "He did not laugh as his eyes stopped in awareness of the earth around him. He looked at the granite, to be cut, he thought, and made into walls. He looked at a tree, to be split and made into rafters. He looked at a streak of rust on the stone and thought of iron ore under the ground, to be melted and to emerge as girders against the sky, unquote. So there are things an Ayn Rand hero will laugh at and things he will not laugh at. These lines from the opening chapter of the Fountainhead illustrate Ayn Rand's conviction that, quote, humor is the denial of metaphysical importance to that which you laugh at, unquote. It involves the denial of that which contradicts what she calls one's metaphysical value judgments, one's appraisal of reality and man's relationship to it, one's view of what is really important in life. Laughter comes, at least in part, from an awareness of that which does not fit your view of reality, what's important in reality. It is the response that accompanies the recognition of the insignificance of something and the consequent dismissal of it. Now, this conception of humor becomes clearer when we consider the distinction Ayn Rand makes between the metaphysical and the man-made, from the essay of that name. Right? Quote, it is the metaphysically given that must be accepted. It cannot be changed. It is the man-made that must never be accepted uncritically. It must be judged, then accepted or rejected and changed when necessary. Man is not omniscient or infallible. He can make innocent errors through lack of knowledge, or he can lie, cheat, and fake. The man-made may be a product of genius, perceptiveness, ingenuity, or it may be a product of stupidity, deception, malice, evil, unquote. So the metaphysically given is not to be evaluated, but accepted. Since humor involves an evaluation, the metaphysically given is not what we laugh at. What we laugh at, what we negate the metaphysical importance of, must be man-made. That is, certain human ideas, actions, creations, and institutions that contradict one's view of the nature of reality and man's relation to it. This is one reason why Rourke does not laugh at the beginning of The Fountainhead, does not laugh at the earth around him. And of course, the major reason is that his love for this earth and what an architect can do with it. Now, here are a couple examples from The Fountainhead of proper objects of laughter, where you know it's proper to mock, dismiss, what have you. The Peabody Post Office, quote, was the only structure anyone had ever known Professor Peterkin to have erected before he sacrificed his practice to the responsibilities of teaching, unquote. Yeah, that's, by the way, I should mention, I'm not a comedian. Nothing is more awkward than what I call species embarrassment, witnessing a comedian falling flat. I'm not mentioned, you know, these are not to have you, these are, you know, slightly sarcastic and humorous remarks that are meant to illustrate a point. So feel free not to be embarrassed if there's a little laughter, and I'll join you in not being embarrassed. Okay. So, you know, Professor Peterkin, he erected one building before sacrificing his practice to the responsibilities of teaching. Now, you've heard the expression that I'm sure doesn't apply to anyone in this group, those who can, do. Those who can't, teach. Right? This is Professor Peterkin, who we learned a little earlier in the novel had threatened to resign if Rourke was not expelled. He's presented as a mediocrity who chose to teach. He's a teacher of design. He chose to teach rather than practice architecture. Now, instead of simply saying so, Ayn Rand, the narrator, dismisses this old fraud with a bit of humorous sarcasm, which I think matches his own pomposity. If you hear the way he talks to Peter Keating in the novel, he sacrificed his practice to the responsibilities of teaching. Incidentally, this is not meant to knock the teaching of design. I listened to a lecture a couple days ago on design by Brian Ammerich. That was really excellent. But I'm sure the content of that lecture was quite different from what Professor Peterkin dished out, to say the least. Okay, here's another example. Eve Layton, quote, had the special faculty of making satin and perfume appear as modern as an aluminum tabletop. She was Venus rising out of a submarine hatch. She believed that her mission in life was to be the vanguard. It did not matter of what, unquote. Now, this is every Hollywood has-been or wannabe or a famous heir, famous for being famous, right? Isn't there a whole tribe of Kardashians like that? And Ayn Rand is dismissing her as contemptible with humor, right? And the dismissal has something in the form of a joke. Her mission in life was to be the vanguard. And your mind's thinking the vanguard of the proletariat, of Eastern religion, of a return to nature, of it doesn't matter of what, right? So, you know, any politically or culturally correct flavor of the week. Now, to return to Howard Roark, he can laugh at the thing that had happened to him that morning and at the things which lay ahead, because he regards his expulsion from the university, the dean, the opinions of the faculty who wanted him gone, and the things which likely lay ahead as inconsequential. They are not metaphysically, that is to say, they're not deeply or fundamentally important. And this is especially true for Roark, who is particularly unaffected by other people. And incidentally, for the young people here, the newbies or whatever, there is no objectivist commandment, thou shalt laugh at being expelled or fired or whatever. This is has a particular context, a particular here man, and you know, you have to sort all that out. Now, why does Ayn Rand have him laugh at his, you know, at this expulsion and the other things, rather than simply ignore it or dismiss it as unimportant without laughter? Well, I can only speculate about her motives, but I think I'm on pretty solid ground. In part, perhaps in large part, I think she wants immediately, at the end, the opening of a novel is important, she wants to immediately convey something about Roark's, and so her own, a joyous sense of life. But further, humor involves incongruity, and she says she shares that view. It involves what is unexpected or what doesn't fit or what doesn't seem to fit. I expect the laughter is prompted by the fact that Roark is relieved at and pleased about his expulsion, which, like almost everything else about him, sets him apart from everyone else. And this is confirmed by Roark's conversation with the dean, which I'll pass over here, and earlier by Mrs. Keating. By Mrs. Keating, that's right. And her reaction to Roark's clothes when he's going to visit the dean, right? Roark is wearing jeans, sandals, and a short sleeve shirt, missing most of its buttons. So if you're a poor young student concerned about the Ocon dress code, you have strong, solid textual support for your laid-back, casual look. Okay. Anyway, here's the exchange. "Mr. Roark," she gasped, pointing to his clothes, "you're not going like this." "Why not?" "But it's your dean." "It was." And then the narration continues, "she thought aghast that he said it as if he were actually happy," unquote. And I think that's why he laughs in a way, or part of it. Now, I really enjoy seeing parallels between Ayn Rand's novels and other great works of literature that she was fond of, not to diminish her originality, but I think there are possible influences in things. And there's a scene in Les Miserables where Hugo is talking about the young revolutionaries, and there's one point, L'Aigle, I think it's pronounced, excuse my French, he confronts Marius with the claim that Marius inadvertently caused him to be expelled, and Marius is devastated, and then L'Aigle says, well, quote, "he burst out laughing, I'm delighted, I was on my way to being a lawyer," and being struck off the list saved me, he says, unquote. So maybe that was percolating in her subconscious when she was writing that scene. Don't know. So anyway, that's why Roark laughs at the opening of the novel. Now, had he a very different view of life, a more malevolent view of the world and the people in it, if he regarded this his expulsion as important, as the loss of a value, or took it as evidence that greatness is doomed, he would not have laughed. And certainly, if Dominique and Roark were together at this point in the novel, at this point in her life, she would not have laughed, and for that very reason. It would be a confirmation of her mistaken a malevolent outlook, her view that greatness is destined to be destroyed by a world that doesn't evaluate. And if someone very different from both Rourke and Dominique, say Ellsworth Toohey, were around and aware of Rourke at this point in the novel, he too would have laughed at Rourke's expulsion, but for very different reasons from Rourke, right? To undercut the significance, not of the expulsion, but of a man like Rourke, or at least to pretend to, right? And or to express the view or the hope that greatness is irrelevant or illusory. And it would have been a very different sort of laughter, a malicious, sneering laughter. Now, to illustrate the distinction between benevolent and malicious humor, Ayn Rand sometimes, in fact, I think I can say in every one of her extended discussions of humor, Ayn Rand refers to this passage from Atlas Shrugged, quote, "Watching them, Dagny thought suddenly of the difference between Francisco and her brother Jim. Both of them smiled derisively, but Francisco seemed to laugh at things because he saw something much greater. Jim laughed as if he wanted to let nothing remain great," unquote. Now, this latter is how Toohey laughs as well, though much more self-consciously, as we'll see. And I'll have more to say on that laughter later. I don't know if you can see me checking my phone, but I'm not checking soccer scores. I think it's too early for that. I wanted to see what the time was. Okay. So, not all humor is the same. It is not all morally equivalent. In Bootleg Romanticism, which is a very important essay for understanding Ayn Rand's conception of humor, she writes, quote, "Humor is not an unconditional virtue. Its moral character depends on its object. To laugh at the contemptible is a virtue. To laugh at the good is a hideous vice," unquote. So you could say that for Ayn Rand, humor, in fact, involves punching down. If by down you mean the low, that is, the low morally or rationally or aesthetically, it's the contemptible. If a person is rational and moral, she argues, he will laugh at what is absurd or, within limits, what is evil. If one is irrational or immoral, one will laugh at what is good and rational, as this is what one wants to dismiss from reality as unimportant, as in my hypothetical case of Toohey laughing at Rourke's expulsion. This would be her conception of punching up, punching the good, and I believe it is, though left to implication, part of Trudeau's conception of punching up, which he approves of. It's the big difference. Of course, Ayn Rand does not believe it is appropriate to laugh at all evil. She once said, quote, "Humor is destructive, which is proper, but its value and morality depends on what you're laughing at. If you're laughing at the evil in the world, provided you take it seriously, but occasionally permit yourself to laugh at it, that's fine," unquote. And elsewhere she says, quote, "When I say it is proper to laugh at evil, I do not mean just any evil, because it is improper under all circumstances to write humorously about," this was in a writing course, so she's talking about it there, "about tragic and painful events or issues, about death, cemeteries, torture chambers, concentration camps, executions, etc. This is called sick humor, and the designation is correct," unquote. Pardon. I think we're now in a position to contrast further Gary Trudeau's conception of the proper and improper object of humor with Ayn Rand's. And it's an excellent illustration of thinking in inessentials versus its opposite. Trudeau is guilty of a double or corollary package deal. He is right that one should not properly laugh at a person who is suffering through no fault of his own, the sick or diseased or victims of crime or dictatorship. This is sick humor. Right? Nor are racist jokes appropriate, and in that sense you could say laughing at minorities is improper. But Trudeau combines such things. He packages them with anyone who according to his own conception of philosophy, is marginalized or oppressed. So he's combining in essentials. That's what a package deal involves. So on his view, we should not laugh at any non-Western religion or ideology, however irrational or evil. He calls this ridiculing the non-privileged, right? And he has a real double standard here, because he's written some really brilliant columns criticizing evangelical and creationist Christians. He's happy to mock them, but somehow, because they're in some conception privileged, but not Muslims who do horrible things or believe ridiculous things. Further, Trudeau is right that certain uppity and snooty rich people, for the Hollywood elite, and the, for example, the pretentious New Yorkers who Tom Wolfe satires in Bonfire of the Vanities, these are fair objects of humor, as are corrupt politicians and oafish third world dictators, as long as you take their evil seriously, as Ayn Rand puts it. But Trudeau packages these objects together with anyone he wants to mock, considering all of them the privileged or the comfortable, for, you know, anyone who's a Republican or a businessman of any kind. So his conception of humor is a rationalization, allowing him to laugh at whatever he dislikes politically or culturally, while protecting what he supposedly values. But ultimately, as I've indicated, I think this is just a thinly disguised hatred of the good, right? The up, properly conceived. And this conception of humor, as I said before, is widespread. For instance, it's what allows Obama, on the one hand, to mock Ayn Rand, and on the other to say that, quote, the future must not belong to those who slander, that is, mock, the prophet of Islam, unquote. Now contrast Ayn Rand's, Trudeau's view with Ayn Rand's essentialized conception of the object of humor. She says, to laugh at the good is a hideous vice, you know, period. In essence, fundamentally, it is always wrong to laugh at the good, the rational and the moral, wherever one finds it, right? Whether they are comfortable or not. In the same way, to laugh at the contemptible is a virtue, irrespective of the religion, the social standing, the comfort level, the political party, etc., of the object of one's humor, given her qualifications about taking evil seriously and her comments about sick humor. It is irrational to condemn drawings of Mohammed and to demand that Western countries codify this in law or in unwritten social mores. And so it is appropriate to treat these negatively through humor, as Charlie Hebdo did, whatever you think of the quality of their humor, but there's been better humorous criticisms, like the Danish cartoons, for example. Okay, let's return to The Fountainhead. Humor in the novel takes both forms, the proper and the improper. Ayn Rand employs the proper form of humor to laugh at the contemptible, and she uses the improper form, of a particularly venal type of the improper form, to characterize Ellsworth Toohey. And I want to look first at examples of the proper humor in The Fountainhead, laughing at the contemptible. Now, we saw a couple examples of this already, Professor Peterkin and Eve Layton, right? And these kinds of humor that I want to show a few more examples of, they're common in The Fountainhead, but not in Atlas Shrugged. Okay. The kind of humor I want to emphasize here is that these are humorous remarks that aren't said by a particular character. They're actually part of Ayn Rand's narration, which is interesting. It's interesting that her narration here is sarcastic. And I'm referring to her descriptions of, I talked about that already. And just to be clear, by sarcasm I mean, and this is one Cambridge dictionary, quote, the use of remarks that clearly mean the opposite of what they say, made in order to criticize someone or something in a humorous manner, unquote. And here are three more examples. Quote, the Stanton Institute of Technology looked like a medieval fortress with a Gothic cathedral grafted to its belly. The fortress was eminently suited to its purpose, with stout brick walls, a few slits wide enough for sentries, ramparts behind which defending archers could hide, and corner turrets from which boiling oil could be poured upon the attacker, should such an emergency arise in an institute of learning, unquote. And that's sarcasm. Quote, Cosmo Slotnick adored boy geniuses. Mr. Slotnick was one himself, being only 43, unquote. Again, sarcasm. Now, this next one concerns the selection process at the Hopton-Stoddard Home for Subnormal Children. Quote, 65 children, their ages ranging from 3 to 15, were picked out by zealous ladies who were full of kindness and so made it a point of rejecting those who could be cured and selecting only the hopeless cases, unquote. That's mildly sarcastic. The reason Ayn Rand added touches of sarcasm in her narrative is clear. She wished to mock, to criticize, to underscore the insignificance of the objects of her sarcasm. And she did this without overdoing her use of it, though I think there's a lot more of it here than there is in Atlas Shrugged. That the Stanton Institute of Technology was built to resemble a medieval fortress deserves criticism, but not a serious critique, at least not in The Fountainhead. The same is true of Mr. Slotnick's evaluation of himself as a boy genius, for he is neither. Now, the third example is a bit different because the idea implied in the action is so evil. But I think it works. I don't think it amounts to being inappropriate or sick humor because it's the humor is directed, the sarcasm is directed not at the enormous evil involved, the idea of choosing hopeless cases over cases for which there is some hope, right? But at the hypocrisy of the zealous ladies who act in this way and consider it kindness, right? The world is full of such altruists and people that admire them. Now, Ayn Rand would later say in The Art of Nonfiction, which is based on a nonfiction writing course she gave, quote, sarcasm should be used sparingly. The general principle is to prepare the ground for what you want to treat sarcastically. Make sure it is clear why you are making a sarcastic remark. When you have prepared your ground, a touch of sarcasm can be stylistically brilliant. Unquote. Now, I think Ayn Rand did this and did this well in The Fountainhead. And so did Dominique Francon early on in the novel when she wrote a regular newspaper column entitled, anyone know the title? Trivia question? I heard it. Yeah, Your House. And I should mention, however, that she's way more sarcastic than Ayn Rand is. And I think that's because it's an expression of her bitterness about the world. So here's the passage she wrote on the Ainsworth House designed by Peter Keating. I actually thought of this in Brian's design class the other day when he presented the facade of a very expensive house with pillars that did nothing and et cetera. But so I don't think it was as bad as this one, though. We'll see. Quote, so this is Dominic's article describing this house, and it's a positive description, sort of. Quote, you enter a magnificent lobby of golden marble, and you think that this is the city hall or the main post office, but it isn't. It has, however, everything. The mezzanine with the colonnade, and the stairway with a goiter, and the cartouches in the form of looped leather belts. Only it's not leather, it's marble. The dining room has a splendid bronze gate placed by mistake on the ceiling, in the shape of a trellis entwined with fresh bronze grapes. There are dead ducks and rabbits hanging on the wall panels in bouquets of carrots, petunias, and string beans. I do not think these would have been very attractive if real, but since they are bad plaster imitations, it's all right. The bedroom window faces a brick wall, not a very neat wall, but nobody needs to see the bedroom, unquote. So I think it's a brilliant line. Now, Dominique is clearly enjoying sarcasm. Employing. Maybe both. Yeah, I think so. She does not believe, and I think Ayn Rand was enjoying herself too. She does not believe that the lobby is magnificent, that the bronze gate splendid or placed on the ceiling by mistake, the bronze grapes fresh, the bad plaster imitations or the misplaced walls or windows, all right. There is one noteworthy difference, however, between Dominique's article and Ayn Rand's similar narrative, aside from the quantity, which is probably related to this point. Dominique is mocking her readers as much as she is the Ainsworth house and its architect. She is writing for a world that she believes despises heroic values. And this is in part her way of trying to come to terms with that world or to live in it, in a sense. And even note the remark about the bedroom that you can't, you know, it doesn't matter that the walls are blocked, the windows are blocked by walls, because who needs to see the bedrooms or who can see the bedrooms? It's as if the house is designed for the rest of the world, not the inhabitants of it. And that's a suggestion about their reference to their second-handedness. Now, Ayn Rand's humor, by contrast, is not directed at her audience. Now, another instance of or kind of laughing at the contemptible that one encounters in The Fountainhead is the mockery of modern art, particularly classicist architecture and avant-garde literature. Now, Ayn Rand continues the above passage on sarcasm from The Art of Nonfiction as follows, quote, "There are some subjects which one can discuss only sarcastically, that, for example, the hippies or modern art. There, the subject gives you the necessary ground. It is a caricature in itself, and therefore you cannot evaluate it except in sarcastic terms, though you can discuss its psychological and philosophical roots seriously." Quote, unquote. It is no surprise that in a novel in which an architect with integrity clashes with mediocrities and second-handers who draw solely on tradition in designing their buildings, the author would include comic presentations of some architects and buildings. And we've seen a couple examples of that, and I discuss more of this in the in my essay, Humor in the Fountainhead. But because time is short and running out, I'm going to limit myself to Ayn Rand's satirical presentation of a group known as the Council of American Writers. Now, this council consists of writers who are even worse in their field than the bad architects of the novel are in theirs, because the latter, I mean, their buildings have to stand at least, right? So, and in her view, is these have to be presented humorously or sarcastically, because they're a parody of themselves. They're caricatures of themselves, in a sense. Ellsworth Toohey was the organizer of this, but not a member of the Council of American Writers. Lois Cook was the chairman and only famous member. Quote, "The rest included a woman who never used capitals in her books, and a man who never used commas, a youth who had written a 1,000-page novel without a single letter O, and another who wrote poems that neither rhymed nor scanned." They're now a dime a dozen, aren't they? "A man with a beard who was sophisticated and proved it by using every unprintable four-letter word in every 10 pages of his manuscript." I think that's Henry Miller, but anyway. "A woman who imitated Lois Cook, except that her style was less clear." I like that too. "There was also a fierce young man known only as Ike the Genius, though nobody knew just what he had done," unquote. Now, I assume there are real-life examples for all of these. I mentioned Henry Miller as the vulgar guy. James Joyce has certain these characteristics, so does Samuel Beckett in some instances. There's also, I discovered, not the first to discover, I just found out recently, Ernest Vincent Wright's 1939 novel, Gatsby, is 50,000 words long without the letter E. So this was naturalism on her part. She wasn't making this stuff up. I should mention As he also makes an appearance, the critic Jules Fogler, who is a fellow traveler but not a member of the council. You know, I'm an individualist, he says. I don't join things. Just like Rourke. So I'll begin with Lois Cook. Eldred Tooey describes her as, quote, the greatest literary genius since Goethe, unquote. She writes, he says, quote, not exactly novels, no, not collections of essays either, stories either. That's just it, just Lois Cook, a new form of literature entirely, unquote. And Ayn Rand's journals make clear that she's referring to Gertrude Stein. In the notes she made while writing The Fountainhead, Lois Cook's name was originally Gertrude. And at one point, Ayn Rand refers explicitly to Stein. The Cook-Stein connection is evident in a passage that she gives us from Lois Cook's, I should stop asking trivia questions, you'll get that tonight, from Lois Cook's book. No, not a novel. It's, It's called Clouds and Shrouds. It's a record of Miss Cook's travels around the world. Quote, toothbrush in the jaw, toothbrush, brush, brush, tooth, jaw, foam, dome, in the et cetera. I don't want to read all that. Okay. Now, here's a line from Gertrude Stein's 1922 essay. It's called Americans. It's from a book of hers called Geography and Plays. You know, shrouds and clouds, geography and plays. Quote, never sink, I'll try to give it the grandeur it deserves. Never sink, sinker, sink, sinker, sunk, sink, sink, sinker, sink, unquote, et cetera, ad nauseum. And Ayn Rand would certainly regard this this kind of so-called literature as a subject that cannot be treated, that can only be treated sarcastically. She would claim not that the writing of Lois Cook is a parody of Gertrude Stein, but that Stein, it's a copy of it. Gertrude Stein's writing is a joke in itself. It's a caricature of itself. It's a parody of literature. It's irrational and unintelligible, and as such, incapable of evoking any genuine aesthetic response. Only boredom and disgust, or if you're in her camp, kind of some kind of amusement, sharing in the laughter. Now, I don't know if Ayn Rand had anyone in particular in mind in creating the character Ike the Genius, but no doubt he represents some aspect of the absurdist avant-garde theater that was fashionable in the 20s and 30s. We discover that Ike the Genius is a playwright who, at 26, had written 11 plays, though none of them had been produced. In one scene, he's reading his newest play to his friends from the Council of American Writers, and their consensus is, it's awful. Ike responds, quote, if Ibsen can write plays, why can't I? He's good and I'm lousy, but that's not a sufficient reason, unquote. And against the general consensus that the play is awful, Jules Fogler declares, this is a great play, said Jules Fogler. He wore a suit beautifully tailored of a color to which he referred as merde d'oie, goose shit, excuse my French. He kept his gloves on at all times, and he carried a cane. He was an eminent drama critic. Now, Ike the Genius says, quote, to write a good play and to have it praised is nothing. Anyone can do that, anyone with talent, and talent is just a glandular accident. But to write a piece of crap and have it praised, well, you match that, unquote. And Jules Fogler adds in the same spirit, quote, what achievement is there for a critic in praising a good play? None whatever. I have a right to wish to impress my own personality upon people, unquote. And shortly after, we discover the title of this play in a bit of humorous exchange between Fogler and Ike that's reminiscent of, it's a vulgar bit of wordplay in the fashion of the Who's On First skit from Abbott and Costello. Quote, therefore I, this is Fogler speaking, therefore I shall make a hit out of, what's the name of your play, Ike? No skin off your ass, said Ike. I beg your pardon? That's the title. Oh, I see. Therefore I shall make a hit out of No Skin Off Your Ass, unquote. Now, later we discover that the play is a big hit, and Jules Fogler, recommending it to Peter Keating, says, quote, "It's the kind of play that depends on what members of the audience are capable of bringing with them into the theater. If you are one of those literal-minded people with a dry soul and limited imagination, it is not for you. But if you are a real human being with a big, big heart full of laughter, you will find it an unforgettable experience." I have a healthy subconscious that's my Freudian slips are good ones. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So what kind of laughter does Fogler expect the play to evoke? We're given a clue in a conversation between Tui and Ike the Genius, one that provides a suitable transition between Ayn Rand's use of proper humor in The Fountainhead and her presentation of improper humor. Quote, "Ibsen is good," said Ike. "Sure he's good," Tui responds. "But suppose I didn't like him. Suppose I wanted to stop people from seeing his plays. It would do me no good whatever to tell them so. But if I sold them the idea that you're just as great as Ibsen, pretty soon they wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And then it wouldn't matter what they went to see at all. Then nothing would matter, neither the writers nor those for whom they write," unquote. Ike the Genius's play is Tui's and Ike's joke on Ibsen, the theater, and theatergoers. Artists and critics like Lois Cook, Ike the Genius, Jules Fogler, Ellsworth Tui are nihilists. They laugh at all values. They spit in the face of greatness. Now, later in the 1960s, when asked in an interview, the one I mentioned earlier, for an example of humor that laughs at the good, Ayn Rand replied, quote, "The phenomenon of today's theater of the absurd. What does it laugh at? At the nature of the universe, and particularly at man's consciousness. The purpose is to express the idea that man is incapable of grasping anything, that the universe is unintelligible to him, and that man is ridiculous because he attempts to understand and fails," unquote. Similarly, Louis Sass in Madness and Modernism, you may know the book because Dr. Peikoff devoted an entire Ford Hall Forum to this book. He writes, quote, this is Sass, not Peikoff. He writes, quote, "It is only in the modernist era that we find artworks whose most central attitude is not to communicate or to celebrate, but to pour scornful laughter on the whole of existence," unquote. Now, in mocking modern art in The Fountainhead, Ayn Rand is mocking malicious laughter. And laughing at modern literature serves to remind us that the universe is benevolent, that in the end, the evil and the insipid do not matter. What matters is great art, which of course has a more central place in The Fountainhead. But though we may permit ourselves to laugh at malicious laughter from time to time, to use Ayn Rand's formulation, we must also take it seriously. And so I want to expand on this discussion by turning to Ayn Rand's use of the kind of humor to Ayn Rand's use of this kind of humor to characterize Ellsworth Tui. And in doing so, to return to the topic of humor in the 21st century. Ellsworth Tui, the arch villain of The Fountainhead, is an explicit advocate of selflessness. And in fact, as he describes himself to Peter Keating, quote, "He is, quote, the most selfless man you've ever known," unquote. Now, his advocacy of selflessness is a corollary of, or a excuse or cover for, his hatred of all values. As Ayn Rand puts it later in The Objectivist Ethics, quote, "Only a rationally selfish man, a man of self-esteem, is capable of love, because he is the only man capable of holding firm, consistent, uncompromising, unbetrayed values. The man who does not value himself cannot value anything or anyone," unquote. And Tui's selflessness and hatred of values is connected to his conception and use of humor. To complete her portrayal of this central aspect of Tui's character, Ayn Rand makes him a master at a most malicious kind of humor. Tui does not merely laugh as if he wanted to let nothing remain great. That's James Taggart. Right? He is more calculated and methodical. He laughs to prevent something or someone from remaining or becoming great. As Ayn Rand described him in her notes for The Fountainhead in the Journals of Ayn Rand, quote, "Sarcasm is his pet weapon, as natural to him as smell to the skunk, as a method of offense and defense. He is magnificently, maliciously catty. He does not fight his opponents by straight argument or logical refutation. He disqualifies them from the game, dismisses them by mockery," unquote. And towards the end of The Fountainhead, Tui explains his recipe for achieving power, including political power, over others. One ingredient is laughter. Quote, "Kill by laughter. Laughter is an instrument of human joy. Learn to use it as a weapon of destruction. Turn it into a sneer. It's simple. Tell them to laugh at everything. Tell them that a sense of humor is an unlimited virtue. Don't let anything remain sacred in a man's soul, and his soul won't be sacred to him. Kill reverence, and you've killed the hero in man. One doesn't reverence with a giggle. He'll obey, and he'll set no limits to his obedience. Anything goes. Nothing is too serious," unquote. In contrast to Ayn Rand's conviction that humor is a conditional virtue, Tui contends that one should laugh at everything, especially the good. Laughter directed at the good aims to wipe out, to deny the importance of, to kill anything serious, sacred, heroic. And this is a dangerous idea. Now, I've encountered a couple examples of this same kind of this connection between this sort of humor and nihilism in earlier works that Ayn Rand admired that I think are worth mentioning. There is a scene in Dostoevsky's Demons, similar to this passage, in a somewhat similar context. Verkhovensky, if that's the good pronunciation of the Russian, is describing to Stavrogin his recipe for achieving their ideal, which is nihilism. Quote, "First we'll get trouble going. I'm a crook, really, not a socialist. Listen, I've counted them all up. The teacher who laughs with children at their god and at their cradle, he is already ours. Jurors who acquit criminals right and left are ours," unquote, and etc. And he's presenting his list of possible unwitting allies to in their battle for nihilism. But my point is that top of the list is getting people to laugh at what is considered sacred. And for Dostoevsky, that's God and family. And there's a similar scene, well, not a similar scene, but there's a similar character who's a little better psychologically in Les Miserables, one of the young revolutionaries, because the young revolutionaries have different backgrounds, they have different ideologies. And one is an interesting character, Grantaire. It's, quote, "Grantaire came very close to having no meaning whatsoever. He could not take them," the other revolutionaries and their ideals, "seriously. Skepticism, that dry rot of the intellect, had left him with not a single idea intact. He lived with irony," unquote. And I take it that irony here is similar to the role that sarcasm plays. He has one saving grace. He has one value. He loves Enjolras, and that, well, I don't want to give away too much or more than I have already, that kind of saves him in a sense, spiritually. Okay, back to Tui. Here's a heartbreaking instance of his killing by laughter. After Keating tells Tui that he loves Catherine, this is a really important thing. What does Tui do? Quote, "How pretty. Young love, spring and dawn and heaven and drugstore chocolates at $1.25 a box, the prerogative of the gods and the movies. I understand and I approve. I'm a realist. Man has always insisted on making an ass of himself. Oh, come now, we must never lose our sense of humor." He's seeing a reaction in Catherine, right? Or maybe Keating too. "Nothing's really sacred but a sense of humor. Still, I've always loved the tale of Tristan and Isolde. It's the most beautiful story ever told, next to that of Mickey and Minnie Mouse, unquote. Now, later, Keating tells Tui that he and Catherine met 7 years ago, and Tui replies, quote, "And it was love at first sight, of course." "Yes," said Keating, and felt himself being ridiculous. "It must have been spring," Tui says. "It usually is. There's always a dark movie theater, and two people lost to the world, their hands clasped together. But hands do perspire when held too long, don't they? Still, it's beautiful to be in love, the sweetest story ever told, and the tritest. Don't turn away like that, Catherine. We must never allow ourselves to lose our sense of humor," unquote. After leaving Tui's place, Keating and Catherine are walking hand in hand, quote, "Then Peter thought suddenly that hands did perspire when held too long, and he walked faster in irritation. He thought that they were walking there like Mickey and Minnie Mouse, and that they probably appeared ridiculous to passers-by," unquote. So Tui killed by laughter. He killed this moment, and he contributed to killing Keating's relationship with Catherine, one of Keating's few seemingly genuine values. And it, Greg Salmeri talked about Catherine becoming a husk or an empty vessel yesterday, and this is one of the ways in which Tui did it. Tui, like Trudeau, but much, much worse, thinks that we should punch up. Keating was a successful architect. Catherine wasn't poor or ill. They're happy in their romantic love, or seem to be. And Catherine, came to New York excited about the prospects that it offered her, and that's what kind of prompted Tui to take her in. So they were fair game. Now, Ayn Rand describes this kind of outlook further in Bootleg Romanticism. And I didn't find the time to type this in. I beg your pardon. She writes, quote, "Too often, humor is used as the camouflage of moral cowardice. There are two types of cowards in this connection. One type is the man who dares not reveal his profound hatred of existence and seeks to undercut all values under cover of a chuckle, who gets away with offensive, malicious utterances, and if caught, runs for cover by declaring, 'I was only kidding,'" unquote. Talk about the other type in a moment. So that's Keating. Tui does not come straight out and say, romantic love is an illusion, I don't care, it's worthless to me, it is no... No, he talks about it, but with a chuckle, and, if someone looks, askance or replies to it, it's, we must not lose our sense of humor. Now, as I said at the outset today, one of my motivations for wanting to discuss humor was earnest, given that issue in connection with the state of the culture. And I want to end my talk with a comment about that from a somewhat different angle than the point I made about Gary Trudeau. It concerns you and the things you regard as sacred, and what this implies, right? And especially, but not exclusively, for any of you who consider yourselves objectivists, and I assume a great many of you do, it concerns the objectivist movement and its relationship to the broader culture. We who are trying to change the culture were also influenced in various ways by that culture. Take, for instance, art and what we like as entertainment. In 1969, nearly 50 years ago, in her introduction to the Romantic Manifesto, Ayn Rand was trying to convey to her readers the sense of life of the aesthetic culture into which she was born. Quote, "the last afterglow of the most radiant cultural atmosphere in human history." And she's referring to the Romantic movement at the turn of the century. Quote, "the existential atmosphere, which was then being destroyed by Europe's philosophical trends and political systems, still held a benevolence that would be incredible to the men of today, that is a smiling, confident goodwill of man to man and of man to life," unquote. And I submit that it would be even more incredible today. And vice versa. The kinds of things we like, I'm being presumptuous here, but there it goes. The kinds of things we like, call it our cultural baggage, would be utterly incredible or incomprehensible to Ayn Rand. cartoonish superheroes in place of heroes, and lots of really well-made, well-acted, high production value depravity studies. Right? I'm exaggerating a bit, but there's some good stuff too, but that, I think, is the trend. Each one of us in different ways grew up in a very different culture, cultural atmosphere, or aesthetic universe than the one Ayn Rand described, and the one to which she hoped to help us return. Okay. My point here is that is not that you should chuck all this baggage, so to speak. I mean, I leave you to process your aesthetic preferences in your own way. I mean, artistic tastes are very personal. So is what we choose to binge watch on Netflix. Now, you may choose to reject all this as the depressing remarks of a grumpy old guy. And I don't mean this as this is not an alternative to the optimistic, the rational optimism that your own Brooke talked about. In fact, I think a proper, you know, getting humor right is one way of being a rational optimist. In any case, what I do want to stress in the present context is that there is one common feature of contemporary culture that I urge you to resist as or reject as poison. If you value yourself and your convictions, and this brings us back to the issue of humor. The Tui-esque humor I've described is not rare, though his pure and self-consciously held form of it might be. It is or is becoming, not if not the stylistic norm of cultural commentators, then very common, right? Snark, as we call the phenomenon today, as I understand the concept, is everywhere. Harry Binswanger has referred to this as the age of snark. To quote Camille Paglia, my apologies, out of context, because in context she's wrong, quote, "I despise snark. Snark is a disease that started with David Letterman and jumped to Jon Stewart and has proliferated since. I think it's horrible for young people," unquote. And it is horrible for young people, this is me, not Paglia, in that it conveys the notion early on that in the realm of ideas and politics and culture, it's not, that realm is not serious. And that to be politically aware or active requires nothing other more than a sneer. Making snide remarks about the views one, for whatever reasons, regards as incorrect. Okay. And snark is a common feature of nearly all cultural commentary on Ayn Rand. I discussed one example of this in a piece I wrote for the ARI blog. It's called, quote, "Reply to," it's titled "Reply to an Ant on Behalf of Thunder," and it's a reply to a New York Times review of a theatrical presentation of The Fountainhead. And we find this snark aimed at Ayn Rand mostly, but not only, on the left. I've encountered it, instances of it among conservatives and libertarians who claim to admire Ayn Rand, but they need to apologize that you can't go to extremes. For example, last year at the Cato Institute, and Cato is a libertarian organization who are sometimes our allies. They've got some good people on the board of directors. But anyway, this event was purporting to be a panel on the significance of We the Living. And the Cato representative introducing the panel did so by making snide remarks about The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, comparing them to Disney movies. And this despite the fact that he knew that there were people involved with the event and in the audience who were objectivists, who worked for or otherwise supported ARI. And notwithstanding that he claimed or implied that he admired Ayn Rand. So now, I mean, if one were to complain that this was offensive and inappropriate, given the nature of the event and the people present, I'm guessing he would have replied, you know, "Lighten up. Don't be so grim and uptight. Don't take yourself so seriously. Rand's not, you know, a god, and you know, objectivism shouldn't be a religion," and so on. And I think this is the other type, I'm guessing, that Ayn Rand mentions in Bootleg Romanticism. She says, quote, "The other type is the man who dares not reveal or uphold his values and seeks to smuggle them into existence under cover of a chuckle, who tries to get away with some concept of virtue or beauty, and at the first sign of opposition, drops it and runs, declaring, 'I was only kidding.' In the first case, humor serves as an apology for evil. In the second, as an apology for the good," unquote. Now, I don't mean to pick on this guy, and people who have these conceptions of humor, they're not as bad as Tui, clearly, but this involves a very Tui-esque conception of humor, right? The idea that we should laugh at everything, we don't take anything seriously. As Catherine says to Peter about Tui, quote, "Nothing you thought was serious seems to be when he is around," unquote. And that's what this kind of projects. In the novel, Ayn Rand writes that, quote, "People admired Tui's sense of humor. He was, they said, a man who could laugh at himself," unquote. In The Art of Fiction, she calls this, quote, "one of Ellsworth Tui's most evil lines," unquote. Now, why? As she explained elsewhere, quote, "The worst evil that you can do psychologically is to laugh at yourself. That means spitting in your own face," unquote. "And if you laugh at the good," she continues, quote, "if you laugh at the good, at heroes, at values, and above all, at yourself, you are a monster," unquote. And it's clear why she held this. It follows from her view that self-esteem is one of the supreme and ruling values of one's life, that the self is sacred, that's the theme of Anthem, that, quote, "self-abasement is the antithesis of morality," unquote. That's from Moral Inflation. But I think this is a widespread view that one should be able to laugh at oneself, don't take oneself so seriously, and it usually involves a packaging of two things, the quite appropriate laughter at one's foibles or mistakes in a way that's not malicious, and a more central sort of not taking oneself seriously. So I'm going over, so let me try to wrap up. If you're fighting for the culture that is hinted at the end of The Fountainhead, if you recognize that in fighting for the future, you live in it today, as Ayn Rand puts it, if self-esteem is both a need and an accomplishment, don't laugh at yourself, at your ideals and convictions, at Ayn Rand and her novels, if those are among your sacred values. Don't tolerate sneers at yourself and your convictions, assuming the context is one where you can push back. I was once confronted with this in a context I really couldn't, right? Now, I'll end today. I had more to say about that, but I really should leave room for questions. I'll end today with two one-liners connected with The Fountainhead. The first is from Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil, from a passage Ayn Rand was going to use as an epithet to The Fountainhead. "The noble soul has reverence for itself." And to give Ellsworth Tui the last word, one doesn't reverence with a giggle. Thank you very much.
Hi, Robert. Thank you for your talk. Enjoyed it. I wanted to say that in all the comments Rand has made about humor and the comments I've seen in objectivist commentary, humor seems to be synonymous with laughing at something. It seems to be synonymous with mockery, parody, satire. There are, I think, plenty of examples of humor that don't do that. Just for one would be Abbott and Costello's Who's On First routine that you mentioned in your lecture. Now, to say that that's denying the metaphysical significance of something, I think is stretching the point beyond plausibility. So I was wondering if you think that's a valid distinction and if there's room to be explored in the non-destructive uses of non-satirical humor.
Okay, good question. First of all, there's two parts, I think, in answer to that. One is not all laughter is laughter that connected to humor. I think there's a joyous kind of laughter, laughter simply in enjoying oneself. Greg Solmary, in his talk yesterday, he opened with this lovely scene where the three, you know, they're just kind of people who enjoy each other's voice, and there'd be laughter that's not exactly at a joke or a mockery or something. So I think there's joyous laughter. And I actually, I shouldn't shamelessly plug things again, but I wrote an essay on joyous laughter in, I think it's called Kira Argunova Laughed. It's on joyous laughter in, you know, it's a characteristic of hers. Now, it's interesting. I don't really have a worked out theory, so all I can do is suggest some of the things that Ayn Rand read. She regards, I mean, it's not everything that is a dismissal with is mockery. And she has the view that, for example, in puns and in literary play, you know, jokes and things like that, you are dismissing something, but what you're dismissing is a person's mind's inability to follow some kind of logical connection. But in the case of a joke, it doesn't matter. So you may have missed the pun, or you may, you know, if I ask, you know, if I tell a joke and you don't see where it's going and you kind of laugh at it. The laughter is dismissing something, but it's not in an evil or malicious way. It can be benevolent because all you're dismissing is, you know, my mind failed to, this is her theory, you know, I've not really given much thought, you know, my mind failed to see where this pun was going, you know, where this joke was going, and that's benevolent because it's irrelevant. You could have a really, really good mind, but still you have jokes that you hear that are surprising. So it's not, you know, laughter that's connected with humor is destructive, but it's not destructive in a bad way. And romantic comedies, for example, you are dismissing something as irrelevant, but what you're dismissing is that the kind of miscommunications that happen in Lubitsch comedies and things like that, and the situations they find themselves in. In the end, none of that really matters, so you're dismissing it in a humorous way, but it's not malicious, it's not mockery. Okay.
That was a good laugh. Thank you very much. I have a question regarding self-deprecating and destructive humor, really. I mean, being a comedian myself, a huge part of my act consists of self-deprecating humor, you know, pretending to be unable to ride the unicycle, pretending not to be able to do this juggling trick, etc., etc. And yet I don't believe I am a monster, you see? And at the same
well,
time...
I don't know you that well.
Okay.
I think that's a good question. I'm glad. It's one of the things I really didn't have time to get in with. Ayn Rand talks about this herself. There are scenes where Dagny seems to be the butt of a joke, but it's in such a benevolent... when she's talking to Axton, you know, you should never do anything but serve hamburgers, you know, she says to him, right? And you wouldn't know what it's like to, you know, I can't find good workers anywhere. And you know, I know a little about that, he says. And so she's the butt of the joke, but it's benevolent, and it's what is being kind of dismissed with laughter is her inability to kind of know what's going on in those. But it's not essential. And I would say, for example, laughing at one's inability to ride a unicycle does not get to the core of one's existence. It's not, if unicycle riding is your profession, and I'm having a hard time projecting this seriously, and you make that the focus of, I'm an idiotic and klutz, I never do anything, and people make fun of you constantly and inappropriately, then if you laughed at that would be, you would have to check your premises, I think. All right. But those kind of things. Now, maybe comedians have to do more of that than a regular person. I mean, if that part of your routine is doing sort of silly kind of things where you purposely, and even that can be, you know, it's something to be proud of if in your own mind you've managed some, something that looks like you're a clumsy unicycle rider. And it turns out that, no, it's all really skilled and everything's intentional. I mean, it's just part of the act. I think your self-esteem is intact and your status as a non-monster, too.
Same thing about, like, destructive humor. For instance, take, I don't know, Laurel and Hardy, Chaplin kind of movies. I mean, they get kicked in the head, thrown out of windows, having swallowed a stick of dynamite, I don't know. And all of us would agree, wow, this is tremendously funny, and yet, you know, this is, I mean, they get themselves killed, so how would you...
Well, those guys dying. I don't know, that's a good question. I don't know that, I have no claims to be able to, if that's a row of people coming up with examples, I'll do my best, but I don't really know. There could be real discussion here, because I find Charlie Chaplin, I like some of his movies, I find him very funny, but Ayn Rand has comments that she thinks there's something aimed in a subtle way, if I remember the comments, at you know, people who aren't tramps, who aren't poor and that he's so there might be a little bit of malice there. That's and Laurel and Hardy, I don't know. I mean, Three Stooges, stuff like that, I find that kind of low.
My question is a bit like the first ones, but put it in another way, I think. Is humor always destructive in any context? For instance, in the case of absurd humor, like the Monty Pythons, for example, isn't only the absurdity of the situation, the nonsense, which is funny without any judgment of the people or the things involved? Or are we laughing at the irrational in this case?
I don't quite know how to answer that. I don't think it's all malicious and bad. I mean, Monty Python, sometimes it gets so silly that I don't find it very funny. Now, I'm a big Monty Python fan, but laughter, often it's often unexpected. Like if you know the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I watched it for the first time in the theater, and when that rabbit goes, you know, the killer rabbit, it's so incongruous, it's so unexpected. These people are, you know, oh, it's just a rabbit, and then it turns out to be a little more than that. Now, that's silly, it's weird, it's odd, but I think it's the unexpected that is the bizarrely unexpected. Now, what are you dismissing with? I mean, these are good questions, and I don't always, clearly, I wouldn't claim to have the answers. It's a whole humorous context. The whole thing is a parody of a certain kind of, you know, King Arthur, whatever, and that's pretty unexpected. And that was, I think, the source of humor. And you can, I guess, dismiss with laughter the fact that rabbits aren't like that. Or I'm not quite sure of that. But I've never looked at all these things. Oh, that's malevolent. Oh, that's malevolent. Because they're not really attacking the good. Now, if you take like Monty Python's Life of Brian, Christians got really upset about that because it's a parody of the life of Jesus. And it's actually an interesting movie culturally because the left defended the movie in many places against countries that wanted to, you know, let's say the life of Muhammad. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be quite the life of Mo. I don't think they're going to be quite, they would not have quite the same view, and that's their hypocrisy or their really high hierarchy of values. So I laughed a lot at the life of Brian, but I can imagine Christians not. So there's going to be a context as well. Are you laughing at what you think deserve to be laughed at, or is someone laughing at your sacred values?
Good morning, Dr. Mayhew. Good morning. Do you approve of the cliche, there's truth in jest? That's one question. And my second question is, do you have a favorite joke? And if you do, would you please share it?
No and no. No, I don't know that saying. I haven't given it. There's truth in jest. It depends on the joke. It depends on, you know, a lot of things.
Context.
As far as the favorite joke, nothing comes to mind.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
In the show Parks and Recreation, there's a prickly individualist named Ron Swanson. Have you ever seen that show?
Oh, I've seen the entire series.
So, yeah. Oh, okay. So, great. So, there's two aspects that I noticed that character. In my immediate reaction was to laugh at all of the situations he's involved in. But on further inspection, I noticed a lot of times what's going on is it seems you're laughing at the fact that he's principled. Like, oh, look at this cute little man who thinks he's got this thing figured out. But then at other times, I think there's aspects where there's other times when there's aspects where you're laughing at how right he is. Oh, wait, this Parks and Recreation Department doesn't matter, and this is the only guy who understands. I was wondering, like, could you comment on that particular example, not to hold you to a literary analysis right
no.
now?
Could you I can only explain, yeah. I can mention my own reaction is that okay. I liked that character and I laughed with him a lot because I didn't interpret him in the more reflective way that, or the second way you described. I saw him, and it's kind of absurd, he's a he's an advocate of limited government. He doesn't like 90% of what the government does. And he works for a government parks and recreation department. And that creates all these interesting comic situations. So I found most of the laughter, and in most comedies, you know, there'd be a mix. You really like certain things, and then, oh, God, that's, you know, a sneer directed at something you value. And you either decide, they've crossed a line, I don't want any more of this, or you take it, and you move on because there's some real value there. I can't recall an instance where I felt they were laughing at this guy's and people like him who have principles. It was just a strange character. Now, I don't know what the creators of the series thought, and that's a different thing. I was reading reading something on Dr. No, and the movie Dr. No, and it was a commentary on the DVD, and the director of the show said that when they filmed the scene where James Bond for the first time says Bond, James Bond, they meant it as parody, as comedy. And that is bizarre. I find that ludicrous, and Ayn Rand even talks about the scene, not that comment, in Bootleg Romanticism. But I find that bizarre, and I dismiss it as stupid, and maybe with laughter. But I don't take it seriously, and that's, I think, what I have to say about that.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.